Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world.
Unfortunately, opposition to GMOs on the left looks very much like the disbelief about climate change that you see on the right.
That's Nick Kaplinski, chair of biology at Swarthmore College, with whom I discussed GMOs. That was towards the end of our conversation, and I have to admit that statement took me a bit by surprise. I was aware that GMOs are a controversial issue, but I didn't realize that there's actually a fair amount of consensus in the scientific community that genetic modification, and as you'll discover, there's disagreement even about what is meant by that, is a useful tool that can be applied towards many different ends, some more laudable than others. To prepare for this interview, Kaplinski suggested I read Nina Fedorov's book, Mendel in the Kitchen. The title of the book refers to Gregor Mendel, the 19th century pea-growing scientist, considered by many to be the father of modern genetics. Fedorov is a molecular biologist who has written extensively about genetically modified foods in an effort to demystify the science. From the outset of Fedorov's book, one understands that the topic of GMOs puts one in an ethically murky, distinctly gray area, and that's not because of the technology per se, but because of the larger issues to which its use is connected. In her preface, Fedorov tracks the increase in human population from the Stone Age, 8 to 10 million, to the present day, 7.8 billion. The biggest explosion happened in the last century when the population doubled and redoubled, from 3 billion in 1950 to 6 billion in just over a human generation. To keep pace with the baby boomers and beyond, farmers have had to capitalize on new technologies, often referred to as the Green Revolution. Fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, and high-yielding crop breeds used to draw more food from the same amount of land. Here's one statistic Fedorov gives us. In 1950, 1.7 billion acres of farmland produced 692 million tons of grain. In 1992, with no real increase in the number of acres under cultivation, farmers grew 1.9 million tons of grain. That's a 170% increase. Without the innovations of the Green Revolution, she argues, more land would have had to be cleared to grow food. Here's a quotation. If India alone had rejected the high-yielding varieties of the Green Revolution, another 100 million acres of farmland, an area the size of California, would have had to be plowed to produce the same amount of grain. That unfarmed land now protects the last of the tigers. Of course, that's not the whole story. Soil scientists are telling us these days that many aspects of farming, the tilling of the land, the use of pesticides, are depleting the fertility of the soil on which we depend. But it's enough of a snapshot to remind us that there's a lot at stake, both for humans and for all other living beings, in how we farm. And of course, as we'll see in my conversation with Nick Kaplinski, the way we farm can have very different implications in one country than in another. Okay, enough stage setting. Let's get to my interview. Nick Kaplinski, as I mentioned earlier, is a professor of biology with a specialty in genomics. He runs a lab at Swarthmore College in which they study the effects of high temperatures on plants, a research project that, as I discovered from talking to him, allows him to delve into deep issues about how life works. I'm going to put an excerpt of our discussion about his research on our website at in-the-weeds.net, but here we'll focus on GMOs. Let's start with, what are they?
How would I define a GMO? So I think my sense is that the best working definition, just for clarity, just so everyone can be talking about the same thing, is that genetically modified organisms are organisms that contain recombinant DNA, that contain DNA that was introduced into those organisms' genomes by humans. That said, right, Fedorov makes a really compelling, and she is not wrong, she makes a compelling case that humans have been genetically modifying foods for millennia, and that the distinction between whether the genetic modification is targeted and precise and done in a lab, or whether the genetic modification was performed in the last century, for instance, using mutagenesis breeding or by creating hybrids by doubling chromosome numbers using colchicine, Or, and she extends the argument that, you know, that during domestication around the world, early farmers were modifying the genomes of the crops that were being domesticated. Those are all forms of genetic modification, right? There isn't a single crop plant that isn't domesticated. And so these plants are different, and the fundamental underlying differences are at a genetic level.
So that's the first definition of a GMO, any plant that has been genetically altered by humans. As Kuplinski points out, the altering of plant DNA to develop new breeds goes back thousands of years to the domestication of our earliest crops, in which Fedorov argues the simple fact of clearing the land and planting naturally occurring hybrids, which likely would not have been able to survive, let alone thrive, without human intervention, led to the creation of plants that were fundamentally different from their wild ancestors. But usually people use the term GMO in a more narrow sense. So in one sense, what distinguishes a GMO, if we want to give a more narrow definition, is the specific technique that is used to modify the genes. And one of her arguments is that if part of our concern with GMOs, by which in this case I mean where a scientist has gone in and actually, you know, directly manipulated the gene themselves, if part of the concern is that it is sort of an overreach in terms of how aggressive our manipulation is, that we should also have concerns about the use of radiation or the use of chemicals, which have been used to develop a lot of crops, right? Like, I think she gives the example of seedless watermelons. I think there are quite a few crops that were developed through these experimental methods, right, that either subjected seeds to radiation or different chemicals. Am I getting that right?
Sure, absolutely, right? So seedless watermelons, you know, much of the rice that's grown in California, ruby red grapefruit, right? All these seedless, bright pink grapefruits were all generated in the 20th century by literally scrambling the genomes of plants and then identifying variants of those plants containing mutations, probably many mutations, probably rearranged chromosomes that resulted in varieties of the plants with traits that are attractive to humans, whether they look good or taste good or both. And so when you use the word aggressive to talk about using molecular approaches to, in a very targeted way, change DNA sequences, on the scale of aggressiveness, the techniques that have historically been considered, counted as conventional breeding techniques are way more aggressive in terms of the scale and the scope of the DNA changes that result. And a key point there is that no one has any idea about what those changes look like or what the ramifications of those changes are. But people are very happy to eat those foods. And the contrast is when scientists go in and make very targeted changes and they know exactly what the changes are, and the changes are minor, often involving a single gene, or these days using gene editing techniques involving just a couple of base pairs of DNA. So we, you know, at some level know precisely what we're doing. This is seen as being much more aggressive or invasive, you know. So the language that's used around this discussion, you know, is very interesting, right? Because language has power, and the way you describe genetic modification comes with fundamentally judgments about the value and the danger of it that's reflected in the language that people use.
Right. So why do you think it is that mutation reading kind of passed under the radar, as it were, and GMOs didn't? Do you think it's just a sort of a historical timing thing about when GMOs arrived, or is there something about that particular technique that sort of pushes a button?
I wouldn't be surprised if at the time people were concerned about mutation breeding. You can imagine that people would see it as being unnatural in some sense, whatever unnatural means. I think it was a different era. The flow of information was more limited. you know, I think the issue with GMOs at some fundamental level is intimately tied up with concerns about multinational seed and chemical companies and policy decisions that drive really intensive agricultural practices. And latching onto GMOs was very similar to the way that the spotted owl became used as an indicator species and a symbol for a much larger conversation about preserving the old growth forests in the Pacific Northwest in the 1980s and 90s, right? It's a single, seemingly simple, pretty sexy issue for people to latch onto. That's really a hook, an entry into a much larger conversation. My sense is that most of the opposition to genetic modification is really driven by a deep level of unease about how we produce food in this country now, and who controls the food supply and what those policies look like.
Right. So let's take an example that might apply to that. Let's take an example of a crop that is genetically modified to be resistant to pesticides.
Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of herbicide resistance technologies out there. The granddaddy of them all is Roundup resistance.
Right.
And this has been used in corn and soybeans and cotton. So for corn, the resistance to Roundup means that farmers can spray Roundup, an herbicide, and kill all other plants in their fields. And this allows them to grow corn using a no-till approach. So instead of controlling weeds with plowing up their fields, they can spray an herbicide. So this potentially has really important advantages for soil conservation, right? Plowing the soil is how you lose topsoil. So the less you disturb the soil, the more likely it is that you can have healthy soil. That's not to say that in an industrialized cornfield, you have especially healthy soil. Before Roundup, farmers used much more dangerous, both for human health and the environment, herbicides to control weeds in their field. So Roundup is about as safe an herbicide as you're going to find. Notwithstanding the current concerns about it being a carcinogen, I'd say the best epidemiological data that comes from large studies of farmers and pesticide applicators who are exposed to very high levels of Roundup, that there's no evidence that it is a carcinogen, to the best of my knowledge. So Roundup has allowed for no-till agriculture, and it's also allowed corn yields to increase because plants, of course, crop plants compete with weeds for resources in a field. And so, you know, if your goal is to drive yield, and American corn yields are amazingly high right now, then Roundup looks pretty good. There are a lot of problems with this, right? Driving, you know, corn is a commodity. So most of the corn grown in this country is feed corn. It's not sweet corn that you'd get in the market. Most of the corn in this country isn't consumed directly by humans. It's used as animal feed. It's used as feedstock for making ethanol. And it's used as feedstock for various chemical processes. So, you know, a lot of plastics, you know, all your toothbrushes are made from plastic that's ultimately made from the starch in corn. And so the reason that corn growers think about yield is because they get paid to grow corn and they're very, very good at it. And they've figured out ways of growing a lot of corn on small amounts of land. Growing corn this way has a huge externalized environmental impacts. These impacts include both the volatilization and the runoff of nitrogen fertilizers. Mm-hmm. But we're really good at it. We're so good at it that corn farmers have decided to grow corn instead of leaving some of their land to grow weeds. And so there are, for instance, across the Midwest, there are very few milkweed plants, which used to grow in cornfields and around cornfields, available for monarch butterflies. And so our ability to grow corn on a vast scale, and so efficiency has a lot of impacts. It's heavily subsidized, you know, so it's very fossil fuel intensive. Diesel is subsidized in farm states as a part of farm policy, and there are a lot of government subsidies for corn growers and soy growers. Ultimately, the reason we do this has nothing to do with anything scientific. You know, from my point of view, this is because every state gets two senators, right? And so, you know, there are corn-growing farmer constituencies in the Midwest states. They have outsized representation politically. And so this drives policies that encourage these farmers to grow corn. It's not especially healthy for the land. You know, most of the corn's used to, or a lot of the corn is used to feed animals. And so that drives meat consumption, which also isn't especially healthy for the planet or for people at the levels that Americans eat meat. But this is how the system is set up politically. So that's one example of herbicide resistance in corn. Now there, as of 2 years ago, there's also dicamba-resistant corn, another herbicide. This has huge problems because dicamba volatilizes and drifts to other fields. And so there are serious issues with farmers killing each other's fields with drifting herbicides. So that's Roundup resistance in corn in America, right? It drives very high corn yields. It allows for very efficient production of large amounts of corn. If you ignore the externalities, the externalized environmental costs, and if you ignore the really significant subsidies that we as a country, through the government, provide to farmers for growing lots of corn. It ties in with history, right? You know, because a lot of the programs that are designed to drive high yields in agriculture in this country started during and before the Second World War, when there simply wasn't enough food. There weren't enough calories for everyone in this country to eat enough. And so conscripts into the army were failing their physical exams because they weren't big and strong enough. They weren't healthy enough. And so as a matter of national security policy, a whole bunch of farm policies were put in place that have been in existence since then to drive the production of lots of food. Yeah. So, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that the technology of genetically modifying plants fits into a political and a historical and a social context that's very nonlinear, and there's no simple story there.
One of the points that Kaplinsky reiterated a few times is that you need to think of GMOs as a tool, and that like all tools, they can be put to good uses and bad uses and everything in between. To illustrate this, he gave me the example of the same genetic modification used in two very different contexts.
So BT refers to Bacillus thuringiensis. It's a bacterium that normally lives in the soil. These bacteria infect and kill and then feed on a variety of insects, including insect pests. And the way that they kill these insects is they have genes in their genome that encode proteins that are commonly referred to as BT proteins. The technical name for the proteins are CRY proteins, and that's because they form crystals inside of the bacteria. And what plant molecular geneticists have done is they've taken the gene that encodes these toxic proteins and put them into various plants with the goal of having the plants make toxins so that the plants become inedible to insect pests. And so in corn and in cotton, we're talking about caterpillars and weevils. And so BT, along with Roundup resistance, is the most widely deployed transgenic trait, certainly in this country, and I would guess worldwide. And the idea here is that instead of spraying really dangerous chemicals to control insect pests, you can have plants make proteins that are quite targeted, as in they kill the pest insects, but they're completely harmless to humans. And then you can protect both farmers and the environment from having to spray the chemicals. I'll point out Bt is widely used by organic farmers. So they spray the whole bacteria on plants. And so you're using the same poison, you're using the same pesticide. It's just made by whole bacteria instead of taking the bacterial gene and putting it into the plant genome and having the plant make the toxin in the absence of the bacteria.
Is there discussion about the ecological differences of those two approaches?
The concerns broadly with chemical control of insect pests and ecological concerns very often center on the development of resistance to the chemicals and getting on a chemical treadmill, right? Where as the pests develop resistance to a particular chemical, you then need to deploy a new, more dangerous chemical. The first documented cases of insect resistance to Bt actually came from organic farms, right? So people certainly worry about, you know, using up the usefulness of these approaches. It's very similar to antibiotic resistance in bacteria and concerns about not having antibiotics available for treating human bacterial infections. So, you know, to me, this is kind of a win-win. You reduce the use of really toxic pesticides. You're controlling pests and driving up yields in agricultural systems. And you're not exposing farm workers to the pesticides. But of course, in the United States, this has been deployed in corn, in soybeans, and in cotton. And these crops are all grown on massive scales. Both corn and soybean really aren't eaten directly by people, right? So they're used to drive an industrial agricultural complex that gives us lots of fabulously cheap meat. And so people certainly argue about whether there's any value in cheap food. I would argue, that it's worth spending money on high quality food that's grown in ways that doesn't harm the environment. The same technology is also being used in India and Bangladesh, where eggplants, they're referred to as brinjals, B-R-I-N-J-A-L-S, are grown on vast scales, but they're grown on vast scales by smallholder farmers and by subsistence farmers. And the eggplants are susceptible to insect pests. Historically, the pests have been controlled through really unregulated application of really dangerous pesticides, right? So you can imagine subsistence farmers without appropriate protective gear, without appropriate training, using chemical pesticides in large amounts and poisoning themselves and poisoning the environment. And so what Bt brinjal has resulted in is really, really significant decreases in pesticide use and pretty significant increases in yields. And so, I think this is a really interesting contrast because you have the same technology, and in this case, the same trait or gene being deployed in two very different contexts.
Yeah, that is a really interesting comparison. I'm curious about the use of bacteria in general. Fedorov talks about a different bacteria, Agrobacterium tumefaciens.
Right.
Which
the shorthand
which
is
the bacteria.
Yeah.
Agro. Okay, great. That's the bacteria that causes galls to grow on a number of plants, including fruit trees, roses, and so on. And how it was discovered that the way that this happens is that the bacteria essentially introduces genes into the plants. And that is then used as a technology by humans to introduce genes into plants, essentially. Is that an appropriate sort of synopsis?
Yeah, that's a very appropriate synopsis, right? So, you know, when we're talking about genes or molecules, we're talking about very real things that are so small that we can't, for the most part, see them directly or manipulate them directly. And so the molecular geneticist's toolkit takes advantage of the tools that nature gives us. So all of our tools come from living systems and come from our understanding of fundamental biological processes. So Agrobacterium is a bacteria that infects plants and genetically modifies plants. And the genes that Agrobacterium inserts into plant genomes direct the plants to create a home and to create food for the bacteria. So the galls are essentially a place for the bacteria to live and to grow. And then what you can't see is that inside of those galls, the plant cells, which now contain bacterial genes, are making these very strange molecules. They're amino acid sugar conjugates, generally, that pretty much only Agrobacterium can use as food. So Agrobacteria are one example, one of many examples of genetic engineering in the natural world.
It's
hard for humans to put DNA into an organism's genome. When people finally understood how agro was causing gall formation, they recognized that they could swap the genes in the bacterial plasmids. So they could swap out the genes that the bacteria were sticking into plants and have the bacteria stick our genes into plants. So we take advantage of Agrobacteria's ability to insert genes into plant genomes to make transgenic plants. There are also other ways of getting recombinant DNA into plants, but agro is certainly an important tool. It's very interesting. A couple of years ago, as people have started to sequence a lot of genomes, a group of scientists discovered, and this isn't surprising in any way, that sweet potatoes, at some point before domestication, had been transformed or genetically modified by Agrobacterium, and that domesticated varieties of sweet potatoes all contain genes that came from Agrobacterium. So the sweet potatoes that you buy in the supermarket and that you eat are not labeled as being genetically modified, but they've actually been genetically modified naturally using exactly the same approaches that some plant biologists use to make genetically modified plants.
So I'd like to talk about genetics a little bit. One aspect that I wanted to highlight was this tinkering thesis. So the idea that our DNA is not just this sort of unique code, as it were, that makes us sort of uniquely who we are, but that all organisms, all living things, are made of similar, although not identical, parts. And the analogy that's used at one point is an analogy of a car, which may mean I'm ill-equipped to make this analogy, but I don't know, what would a standard car part be? Like a carburetor or something like that. So the idea being that, you know, different organisms don't have exactly the same parts, but analogous parts. And that sort of tinkering concept of how DNA works in some ways opens up the gate to genetic engineering. So could you talk about that a little bit and talk about, you know, the sort of the evolution of the way that we understand how DNA works? That's a very big question.
Right. So that's the introductory course that I teach every year. All in one question.
Okay. So we all need to sign up to be undergraduates as well.
Well, you know, I think that gets at one of the difficulties of discussing the technologies that we're talking about, is that to truly understand them, you do have to have a pretty deep understanding of some pretty complex biological processes. So the idea of shared building blocks, right? So all living organisms share a set of fundamental features. All living organisms are made up of cells. Cells are built from a pretty standard toolkit of molecules, and those molecules include nucleotides, that's DNA and RNA. They include proteins. They include lipids that form the membranes that surround the cells. And the closer you get to the core of what it is to be alive and the mechanisms that allow all living cells to be alive, the more you find out that those mechanisms are highly conserved. In other words, they're basically the same in all living organisms. So in all living organisms, the genetic code, the set of instructions for how you make the organism, is encoded in DNA, and the DNA is the genetic material. It's the instructions that are passed on from one generation of the organism to the next. The way that the DNA code is used to make other molecules in the cell is fundamentally the same in all living organisms. And so what that means is that you can then take DNA from one organism, put it into another organism, and it's going to do the same thing in a new context.
Mm-hmm. So that's why you can put a daffodil gene into
Absolutely.
A rice
right?
plant.
So, so the example you're referring to is golden rice. So the current iterations of golden rice no longer use daffodil genes. They use the equivalent gene from corn and put it into rice. But yeah, you can take the instructions for making a part of a living organism, and you can move it from one organism to another, because the language that those instructions are written in and the machinery that's used to read out that language is the same in all living organisms.
Isn't that just mind-blowing? To me, it's another reminder that we are not different from other living organisms, but very much of a piece, or pieces, one might say. Let's return to a subject that was mentioned earlier, golden rice, the humanitarian poster child of GMOs.
And so the story there is that, again, we're talking about subsistence farmers in Southeast Asia and the poorest people who live in Asia subsist fundamentally on a diet of rice, and rice is not complete nutritionally. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of people who get over 50% of their calories from rice. So one of the nutrients that's missing from rice, whether it's brown rice or white rice, polished rice, is vitamin A. People who have vitamin A deficiency have reduced immune system function, and so they die from what should otherwise be non-lethal health problems, like getting diarrhea and gastrointestinal infections. But vitamin A deficiency also results in blindness. And so I think it is 500,000 people a year worldwide go blind every year because of vitamin A deficiency. Right, the numbers are staggering.
I think she says 1 million.
It could be.
Yeah.
So a vitamin is simply a molecule, a nutrient, that an organism needs for the normal function of its cells, for normal physiological function, that the organism can't make for itself. And so by definition, a vitamin is something that you have to get in your diet. Vitamin A precursors are carotenoids. So these are photosynthetic pigments. They're part of what allow plants to photosynthesize. They are present in all plants. So any green portion of a plant is photosynthetically active and contains carotenoids, and carotenoids are provitamin A. They're converted by your body into provitamin A. So, you know, if you have a complete diet, like everyone, for instance, in the United States pretty much does. So this is not a problem that exists anywhere in the developed world. As in, you're eating any leafy greens or any meat, you know, so animals accumulate vitamin A in their muscles, then you don't have vitamin A deficiency. But for people who really subsist on rice and rice alone, you develop vitamin A deficiency and so... As you said, you know, about 1 million people a year go blind, and the number of deaths associated with vitamin A deficiency, I think, are on a similar scale. One solution is to provide supplements. Vitamin distribution programs are pretty widespread and very effective, but they have trouble reaching the poorest of the poor. They do require continuous funding and continuous kind of political and societal support. You can get vitamin A just by diversifying your diet. So by eating some dark leafy greens or carrots, for instance. So your mom was not wrong when she said, you know, that carrots are good for your eyesight. The yellow color in carrots is beta carotene, which is provitamin A. So, you know, there are non-technological solutions to the problem of vitamin A deficiency. Fundamentally, vitamin A deficiency is an outcome of extreme poverty. And so when you talk about poverty, it's very hard not to start talking about inequality. Mm-hmm. So I want to be very, very clear that this is not just a scientific issue. This is an issue of poverty and inequality. It's mm-hmm. an issue that hasn't been solved by supplementation programs. It's an issue that hasn't been solved by reducing poverty so that people can afford a balanced diet. You know, and so obviously, solving vitamin A deficiency doesn't address issues of poverty or inequality, and it doesn't solve all of the other problems that the poorest people on this planet have. So with those disclaimers, there is a biotechnological solution. And so the observation is pretty simple, right? Is that all plants make carotenoids, provitamin A, in their photosynthetic tissues. Rice does not accumulate carotenoids in the part of the grain that you eat. The reason it doesn't is because there are two enzymes that are expressed in the leaf, in the leaves of rice plants that aren't turned on in the grains of rice plants. Mm-hmm. And so golden rice was developed initially using a bacterial gene and a daffodil gene that encoded enzymes that were turned on in the developing rice grain that allowed the accumulation of high levels of carotenoids in the rice grains. And this turns the rice grains bright yellow, because carotenoids are yellow, and thus the name golden rice. The daffodil gene turned out not to work very well. It was swapped out with the corn gene. And so the current iterations of golden rice are rice plants with one gene from a bacterium and one gene from corn plants. And they accumulate very high levels of vitamin A in the rice grains themselves. Now, there's been extensive testing to make sure that that vitamin A is bioavailable, because this was, you know, one of the arguments from anti-GMO activists was that this technology wasn't actually going to work. So feeding trials have now been conducted, and golden rice has been stuck in our regulatory processes for the past, I don't know how many years.
So it's still not in use. It's still not.
Well, it's been approved both in Canada and the United States. But, you know, of course, no one's going to grow it in Canada or the United States. Bangladesh, I think, is the closest to approving it for deployment. You know, so that's supposed to happen this year. And then there are going to be all kinds of questions about whether farmers are going to be willing to grow it and whether people will be willing to eat rice that is yellow instead of white, so you get into issues of education and whether anti-GMO activists will scare the people who should benefit from this technology from even trying it. It's unclear if this is an effective approach to controlling vitamin A deficiency. You know, from first principles, it should be. It certainly won't address other nutritional deficiencies. And as I said, it doesn't address the fundamental issue of poverty. You know, so arguments against it are these vague anti-GMO arguments, and then very real arguments that the fundamental issues of poverty and malnutrition aren't going to be addressed. So this is the poster child for using these technologies for humanitarian purposes as opposed to driving yield and profits for farmers and for industrialized agriculture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you said, I mean, there's this sense that it's a tool and it can be used towards very different ends, right? I mean, one can certainly understand Fedorov's frustration with the fact that this particular case hasn't been put into use because of all of the resistance to it, when it could go a certain way to alleviating the problems of blindness and sickness that these very poor people face.
I mean, you can't go back and redo history, but you know, I wonder if there'd be more of a discussion about these technologies if golden rice had been the first deployment of this technology and its uses to enable industrialized agriculture had come much later.
Towards the end of our conversation, Kaplinsky turned to a deeper underlying concern related to the backlash against GMOs.
I think the other issue of concern for me here is the erosion of trust in scientists. And so, you know, science has never informed policy in the way that scientists would wish that it did. And that's probably okay, because scientists certainly make their fair share of mistakes. But there's been a real erosion of trust in expertise, perhaps in science as well as in many spheres of daily life.
As a scientist, do you have any thoughts about what motivates that erosion of trust or where that's coming from these days?
You know, the two things I would pinpoint are very targeted spending by corporations to influence public opinions and perceptions of these issues. So that very clearly happened with cigarettes and the health risks associated with cigarettes. The same thing has happened with climate change. The oil companies have spent a huge amount of money generating confusion and doubt about the reality of the climate emergency and the anthropogenic nature of the climate emergency. The same thing in a more limited way has happened with genetically modified organisms. The organic industry, and it really is an industry and it's reasonably big money, has spent a lot of money creating fear about genetic modification that directly benefits them and drives sales of organic products. You know, it's certainly in upper middle class households in this country, you will find lots of households where they buy organic produce and would never consider eating anything that's genetically modified. And that's because they've had some real fear put into them by an expensive campaign to drive people to make decisions that economically benefit the industries that are spending the money. You know, so there's money. And then, you know, of course, I like blaming the internet for everything. And at the same time, the internet is totally amazing because it's allowing us to have this conversation.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Coming up, an interview with Doug Tallamy about his new book, Nature's Best Hope. If you haven't listened to my first interview with Tallamy yet, which was my very first episode, I recommend you go back and listen to that in preparation for the new one. If you're enjoying In the Weeds, and I hope you are, please give us an enthusiastic review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell your friends and family to listen too. See you soon.